Hi, I'm Sima Shapiro, the host of the new Contemporary Lifestyle Radio Show for Women Over 40, featuring everything about your health, wealth, children, happiness, and anything else of interest to you, the listener. Please stay tuned. Hi and welcome. I'm Sima Shapiro, your host of For Women Over 40. Today we'll be exploring the world of IVF. What are the newest breakthroughs in medical technology? How does this help support women in their pursuit of motherhood? How prevalent is this becoming, given the fact that advanced maternal age is increasing in so many countries, including our own? We'll be joined by two women passionate about the latest advancements being made in this field and the necessity for making this pathway to motherhood more readily available for all. Dr. Andrea DeLuigi is board certified in obstetrics and gynecology and reproductive endocrinology and infertility, and has specialized in this since 2004. Dr. DeLuigi is an assistant clinical professor of OBGYN at the UConn Health Center, has published numerous articles, and presented her research at several national meetings. Her special interests include IVF, ovulation induction, egg donation, and polycystic ovarian syndrome. Davina Fankhauser is president of Fertility Within Reach, a Massachusetts-based national nonprofit resource center for accessing infertility health benefits and supporting reproductive health preservation. Davina's support and counsel has changed many policies and practices on the legislative level. She testified separately before the Massachusetts Division of Insurance to advocate for IVF coverage in that state and to request CSIRO preservation of eggs be a required benefit for infertility. She is currently working with U.S. Senator Ed Markey to establish a congressional caucus on infertility. So welcome, Andrea and Davina.
Hi. Thank you.
Before we start, tell me a little bit about your own personal journeys to your present position and interest in the fascinating and complex field of IVF. Andrea?
I'm an OBGYN, so I trained in obstetrics and gynecology and was briefly in practice in OBGYN and became a little bit frustrated that I didn't have the technology to help infertile patients conceive. And then I went back and did a fellowship in reproductive endocrinology and infertility, and here I am. And this is what I practice today, and I really love the field.
And Davina?
I was a former IVF patient or infertility patient, and I did not have employer-based insurance, and it took us 16 years to build our family. We've had 10 pregnancies, but we were luckily blessed with two babies, which were a result of IVF. And I just learned to lobby and to advocate along the way, and I thought I really needed to create a resource to teach everyone how to access insurance benefits, so they didn't have to go through what I experienced.
So IVF seems to be the latest buzzword in pathways to parenting. Would you agree, Andrea?
I agree. It's more readily accessible, and it's more common to hear about patients utilizing this technology than it was in the past.
Tell me a little bit about how long has this medical technology been available in this country, a little bit about what advances have been made and why, maybe during the last 5 and 10 years, and please explain IVF stands for what?
IVF stands for in vitro fertilization. It is when fertilization of the egg with sperm occurs outside of the body in a lab. And it's been around for a while now at this point. The first baby that was born utilizing this technology was Louise Brown, and she was born in the UK in 1978. We followed suit shortly thereafter in the US, and we had the first IVF baby born here in 1981. So the technology is not new. It's really been around in our country for about 35 years or so. We have seen vast improvements, especially over the last 5 years, in the technology. We've learned a lot about the conditions to culture the embryos in the lab. For example, different culture systems, different media or solutions that we grow the embryos in, the environment of the air that the embryos are exposed to and grow in. So we've really made significant improvements through research to be able to lead to better success rates, better embryo conditions, better embryo development. And one of the biggest changes that we've seen in the last 5 years is a big push to transfer fewer embryos to make the technology safer for the patients. By transferring one embryo, you can reduce the risk of having multiple pregnancy, for example, twins or triplets. And because the success rates are so high now with the technology, many patients are able to achieve success with just a single embryo transfer, which puts the patient at lower risk throughout the pregnancy. For example, twins have much higher risks of preterm labor and preterm delivery if a woman is carrying a single baby at a time. That's really the safest for both the mother and the baby.
And what is the difference between advanced reproductive services and in vitro fertilization? Are there other ways in which to try to get pregnant?
There are, and that's a great question, because many people think that that's all that we do as reproductive endocrinologists is perform in vitro fertilization, because that's a big buzzword that people hear about in the media. There are other ways to help patients get pregnant, and it really depends on what issue the patient has. For example, women that don't release eggs on their own, that don't ovulate, sometimes those women are able to get pregnant with just finding what the underlying cause is and helping them to be able to ovulate on their own, whether that's correcting a medical problem like thyroid disease or giving the patient medication to help her ovulate. Not everybody needs IVF to get pregnant, so we do have other technologies, sometimes surgical approaches to help patients conceive. For example, patients with endometriosis or scar tissue in the pelvis will sometimes benefit from a minimally invasive surgical procedure to take down that scar tissue and help them conceive. But there are other procedures, too, that we offer patients. For example, intrauterine insemination, or IUI, sometimes it's referred to in the press as artificial insemination, is a procedure in which we place sperm into the woman's uterus to help the sperm get closer to the egg to increase the chances of conception. So there are many other options. What we do as reproductive endocrinologists is see the patient and get a history, do a physical, and do a workup to figure out what the problem is, and then we make recommendations for treatment based on those findings.
So I'd like to set the stage further by getting a little bit of stats. Do either of you have stats for how many women undergo IVF a year or advanced reproductive services? What kind of percentage are successful? What are some of the demographics?
I can tell you that 5 million babies have been born worldwide as a result of IVF technology, and there are many centers throughout the country, and our center, for example, performs more than 1,000 IVF procedures a year.
And how many are usually successful?
The success rates really vary from clinic to clinic, and this is information that patients can obtain online. There's a website, it's the Society for Assisted Reproductive Technology, or SART, where patients can look up centers in their area and see what the success rates are. But I would caution patients to really look closely at those statistics and look at the multiple pregnancy rates, too, because centers can get their success rates to be higher if they transfer more embryos, but it comes at the price of multiple pregnancy, and that's not always a safe situation for patients. So what people should look for is a center that has a high success rate but a low multiple pregnancy rate. And to answer your question a little bit more specifically about success rates, they vary with age. Unfortunately, we see an age-related decline in fertility, and the youngest patients have the highest success rate, and those tend to go down with age, although success rates tend to be high in general until women get into their 40s. As women get closer to 42, 43, 44, unfortunately, the success rates do decrease. But it's also important to keep in mind that natural conception rates are low as women get older, and they're lower than people think. For example, if you had a young patient who is 33 years old, trying to get pregnant any given cycle, success rates for spontaneous conception are not higher than approximately 22% chance per cycle. And that's why it usually takes women several months to get pregnant when they're trying to conceive. When we utilize in vitro, we're helping the patient by taking multiple steps out of the process to get eggs and sperm closer together so we can increase those success rates. So for example, someone that's less than 35 with a single try of IVF, thinking back to our 22% baseline population conception rate in a fertile person, those rates would go up to around 65% or so. So it practically triples someone's chances of conceiving.
Yes, I can share with you what an insurance company looks for in approving benefits for an individual is, do they have greater than a 5% chance of live birth? And there's actually research out there that does support women who are over 40. Yes, the rate of live birth does decrease as they age, but some do have greater than a 5% chance of live birth. And of course, this is always, it's an average. It's research. There's a plus or minus to consider And that's why I believe healthcare should always be individualized. Yes, the research or the SART percentages are an average, but SART, for example, the SART.org Society for Assisted Reproductive Technologies, they even say when looking at the success rates of clinics, you shouldn't use them to compare to others because different clinics have different guidelines and patients and how they practice medicine. For example, how many embryos they transfer, as was mentioned. But you can look at the overall kind of preliminary live birth rate per patient in the country of the United States, looking at all the different clinics that are reporting to SART. And so in 2014, they do break it down into ages. There's less than 35%. You can see the number of patients treated, who had a live birth of a singleton, a twin, triplets or more. And you see for ages 35 to 37, 38 to 40, 41 to 42, and greater than 42. And so you do see the percentages of live birth go smaller as you get older, but still nationally, it's greater than a 5% chance of a live birth. So between research and national statistics, patients can then kind of use some of that information when they're trying to gain benefits or if they've been denied benefits and they want to appeal and try to be approved to move forward in the treatment that they need.
Economics plays a huge factor in this, especially for women in advanced maternal age. And so the demographics must be framed in some fashion by the economics of this. Would you agree, Davina?
I think economics is sadly a foundation of this. It is a bottom line in how patients decide, you know, how they want to proceed with their care. Do they transfer multiple embryos because they can only afford to try this once? Do they give up trying because they feel like they can't afford to go further with care? I think a lot of legislators believe that insurance companies think infertility is far too expensive to offer to people. Every state had to select what was called the benchmark plan to have that be a baseline health plan which all the plans within the Affordable Care Act would need to follow. It would be the minimum health care for all of the benefits every state would offer people who needed a state-run health plan. And then the commercial plans would have to follow this benchmark or baseline plan as well. And in Massachusetts, all the insurance companies selected a benchmark plan that included every mandate in the state of Massachusetts, including infertility. They could have selected a plan for the state that didn't include IVF, but they chose to keep one that did. If infertility treatment and IVF treatment was so expensive, why on earth would they choose a plan that would have that? And the truth is, because there's more savings in having IVF benefits than there is in the cost of offering this insurance coverage. And there's research to support that.
So you're again bringing up an issue about the differentiation between states as well. So Davina, can you talk about this issue and why it differs from state to state? And also, why do some states seem to favor helping women with this and others do not?
I think a little bit gets into a mix of religion and politics. I think legislators vote to have infertility coverage often when it's their constituent that brings it up and that there is a group willing to lobby for it and provide them with the information and resources to help that legislator be a champion for it and to fight for this health care in their state. And if that piece is missing, if nobody steps forward and says, I really need this, if nobody helps that legislator, become an educated voice and a champion for benefits and the cost savings associated with it and the good health care that they could be providing. Without that piece, the ball doesn't get started. It doesn't get moving. So it's not that no one would care about it in a particular state or no one would support it, but without a constituent or a business or someone initiating the conversation and asking, would you help us create this legislation? It's just not going to happen. It's the old saying, if you don't ask, it's not going to happen.
So would it be fair to say that more liberal, higher educated states like California, maybe Massachusetts and Connecticut, would be more inclined to lobby on behalf of their constituents and put pressure on the legislature? Would that be fair?
I wouldn't feel comfortable saying that, actually, because I wouldn't want to offend those who are in states and have lobbied and they didn't receive the outcome that they wanted in gaining benefits. I would say that a lack of access to information and resources, possibly a lack of time, a lack of confidence in the state government may be the reason that more people haven't participated. I wouldn't feel comfortable saying it's due to the demographics that you mentioned.
So would that mean that if a group lobbies and gets nowhere with the legislature and therefore the insurance companies don't follow suit, the statistical increase in IVF and advanced reproductive services would not show itself in those particular states? Is that a fair thing to say?
That is a fair thing to say, but I would add on to that for now, because legislators change. Information changes. The science and technology and advancement of IVF alone has changed significantly even in the past 10 years. So to bear witness to the efficiency and the cost savings and the recognition of providing better health care, I think there are opportunities for the future, even if it doesn't happen the first time. We help people with communicating with their employers and communicating with the insurer directly and sharing research and information, giving them the tools to effectively communicate and make it as easy as possible.
So, Andrea, at what point would you suggest that a woman stop treatment if it is not effective?
I think that's such a tough question because every woman is different and it really depends on what the woman has tried and what the prognosis is moving forward and how comfortable the patient feels with the treatment options that are recommended. For example, not everybody that we think should move forward with IVF wants to move forward with IVF or can afford to move forward with IVF if it's not covered. Now, fortunately, I practice in Connecticut, so a lot of patients that I see do have coverage, which is nice. But if we get to the point as a team that we feel like what we're doing is not working for a patient, we sometimes recommend a second opinion at another center, which could be a nice option for a patient to consider. But we also talk to women and couples about other options for family building. Sometimes a woman can reach the end of this path sooner than someone else might. For example, I've had patients decide to move forward with IVF and have success. Others are not successful after several cycles. I've had people not want to do IVF at all, and they'll look into other options. We have two psychologists that work with us, and patients often benefit from meeting with them to explore their feelings and thoughts about family building. But we do have other options for patients. For example, we'll speak to patients about adoption, egg donation, embryo adoption, or remaining childless. There are multiple different things to consider, but I really think every patient is different, and some people reach their stopping point sooner than others, so it's really individualized.
I'm struck by the fact that we live in an age where so much of what you're talking about, which is just highly technical, is possible. When I think back to our mother's generation and our grandmother's generation, there wasn't any of this. It either worked or it didn't. And I wonder for both of you what you think about living in this day and age. Davina?
I am a huge fan of the advances that they're making in IVF now. And in fact, my choices as a patient 11 years ago would have been extremely different if the technology was what it is today. When I was a patient, I was comfortable with transferring multiple embryos because I could only afford to do it, you know, a couple of times. And I felt like my best chances were with fresh embryos. And now what we're finding with research is you can actually freeze the embryos and then later transfer your thawed embryo, and your success rates are just as good, if not better.
Sure.
It wasn't like that back then. Instead, I just kind of transferred everything.
And Andrea, I'm so struck by the technology behind all this, the possibilities.
I think the technology is amazing, and we've learned so much from research. It's just unbelievable. I think another big point to make, though, is that it's so much more accepted now that people talk about these things. People talk about infertility. There are blogs. Patients talk to each other. And the stigma that was associated with this, and for example, our grandparents' days or great-grandparents' days, it's vanishing, which is really nice to see, because many of us can think of a friend or a relative or somebody from a previous generation that never had children, but always wanted children, and you never knew why, because people didn't talk about it. But women back, you know, decades ago just didn't have access to the care that we have access to today, and they didn't have any options, and people didn't talk about it. So I think things are much better today. Patients have a lot more support. It's a really common problem. Infertility is very common. So patients now, I think, feel more reassured to know that they're not alone. And the technology is so much better now that we can really give these patients hope. And I absolutely believe in the technology. I think it's safe. And this is a journey, and we go through the journey together with our patients here. So we evaluate someone as a whole person or a couple, and we talk to them about all the different options and guide them in the best way that we can, and we take the journey together. But fortunately, most people have success, and it's wonderful, because that was not true 30 years ago.
So let's get around to the topic of Janet Jackson. Along comes Janet Jackson's pregnancy at 49, and out come both the naysayers and a number of women who are contemplating new, older parenthood. The first question I have for you, Andrea, is, has the demand spurned these medical breakthroughs, or have the increasing number of continuous medical breakthroughs fueled this phenomenon?
I think it's probably both. I think there are many variables at play here, but one thing that we know for sure is that women are delaying childbearing more so than they had in previous generations, and that's due to multiple factors. For example, completing education, or waiting to meet the right partner, or getting married, divorced, and then meeting a second partner and trying to become a mother later in life. So this is very common that we see this phenomenon where women are delaying childbearing. And now, with the improvements in technology, pregnancy may be possible for women that wouldn't have had a chance or a very good chance to get pregnant prior to the breakthroughs. But one thing that I do want to say that I think is really important to recognize is that even with this great technology, although it's drastically improved pregnancy rates and outcomes throughout the years, is that we still have physiology to contend with, and we have limits to what we can do even with technology. For example, we have a huge double standard in nature, which is frustrating as a woman, but men can make new sperm every day, and women are born with a supply of eggs that have to last our reproductive years. As we get older, our egg supply diminishes, and the quality of the eggs also diminishes. And as we get closer to menopause, we have fewer remaining eggs, and then eventually we stop having periods and ovulating. So when I hear about someone like Janet Jackson, although I'm very excited for her, I have to say we don't know the details of how she got pregnant. And the most common scenario for a woman who is 49 that is newly pregnant is that that pregnancy may be from an egg donor. That would be the most likely thing, but it's not impossible that she conceived with her own egg at 49. We've all read about those case reports in the literature, and maybe she is one of those very lucky women that was able to spontaneously conceive with her own egg at 49, but we don't know the details.
My other question is, do you have an age limit at UConn for which you will help a woman, and do either states or facilities have specific age limits?
Facilities definitely have limits. What we see, and Davina can probably speak to this more than I can, is insurance limits. Some insurances have age restrictions. In Connecticut, our state mandate recently changed. We previously had a cutoff of age 40. Many women who had plans that participated in the state mandate had 3 covered intrauterine inseminations and 2 covered IVF cycles. Now, that age restriction was recently lifted, so things have changed for patients that have those plans, and more people will now have access to coverage for these benefits. But to answer your question about the age cutoff, many centers do have an age cutoff for treatment, especially IVF. And it's really because the success rates decrease so significantly once women get into their mid-40s that there are ethical issues that are then raised. Is it worth it to put the patient through this type of treatment with a low chance of success? And every patient is different, I have to say. And we evaluate the patient. We do testing on the patient to look for things like their egg supply, their general health, and every woman is different. Every body is different. But as women get to be 46, 47, 48, the options do often change because many times those women have a more difficult time becoming pregnant with IVF, and that's why those cutoffs are in place. But some women can try intrauterine insemination, and then many women in that age group start to think about other options, such as donor egg, either an anonymous egg donor or an identified egg donor, which can be a friend or relative, and things like that. So the age cutoff for that process would be different, and different centers have different cutoffs, but many have a cutoff of around age 50 or 51 for a transfer with either a donated embryo or a donated egg. Because as women get into their 50s, there are other health-related risks associated with pregnancy, too, that we have to keep in mind.
And Davina, your thoughts on this?
The reason the age limit was removed in Connecticut is because the Affordable Care Act specifies that there cannot be a discrimination within a benefit design. And there is enough research to show that this health care is successful after the age of 40. It was felt to be discriminatory by the insurance commissioner. So that is another example of how health care can evolve and be helpful, especially in this case, to infertility patients 40 and over in Connecticut. I did want to say, in terms of Janet Jackson, I think all of the comments are really from a place of judgment. And the fact is, you know, I mentioned before, there's research out there that does say that there is some success over the age of 45. My feeling is that healthcare should be individualized. And if we could just kind of be happy for someone, then I think that would reduce a lot of that confusion to news of older people becoming pregnant.
I want to just say to the listeners, I would remain hopeful, and if you're trying to get pregnant, I'm hoping it happens for you soon, and there is help available if you'd be interested in starting that process.
I just wish them all the best, and I have faith in the reproductive endocrinologist. I think this is an amazing time for women who are in advanced age for reproduction, and if anyone can help them, it is a reproductive endocrinologist.
We've been talking today with two women working in the field of advanced reproductive services and IVF. Dr. Andrea DeLuigi can be found at UConnFertility.com. Davina Fankhauser can be reached at www.fertilitywithinreach.org. I want to thank you so much, Andrea and Davina, for being my guests today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thank you so much to the listener. I'm Sima Shapiro, your host of For Women Over 40. And until next time, I hope you take care.